Okay, well, good afternoon. Welcome to our Ethics Refresher. We're coming live today on December 2nd, 2021 with a conference call program. What this program consists of is just plodding through the rules of professional conduct as they have been adopted in Wisconsin. And in addition, because today we're doing it live mostly for Wisconsin purposes, but many of you will be listening to a recording of this program for a podcast, and we're covering the same rules that have been adopted in other states, such as Minnesota, Nebraska, and Iowa. In the vast majority of the cases, the rules are identical. Because they're all adapted from the ABA Model Code of Professional Conduct with very few changes. However, some of the states do have some little amendments that they've made along the way, so we'll hit on some of those for some of the states. But in general, when I say that, rule number so-and-so says this, for the most part, that's true in all the states where people might be taking it. And I heard another person come on the line, so you must have. Thanks. Thanks for joining us. We just started minutes ago, so thanks. Thanks for calling in. We just started the recording too, because I'm going to be using this program for other states. Those of you who are taking the program live, just a reminder, I'm going to be giving a series of code numbers during the program. But if you're taking it live today on December 2nd, 2021, you don't have to worry about those numbers, because I have your attendance taken care of from the caller ID. So I don't need those numbers from you. But if you hear my voice and it is not December 2nd, 2021, and you're listening to a recording of this program, to get credit for the program after you have listened to it, and there will be instructions on the website of exactly how to do this, but you should write down the code numbers that you hear during the course of the program and send those to me. And just put them in an email or whatever in most cases. If you're taking the program for Iowa credit, you'll need to put it in affidavit form, and you can just cut and paste the affidavit into your email and send that to me. And that's how I take care of attendance. If you have any questions about the content of the program, if you're taking it live today, feel free to just jump in at any time and ask whatever questions you might have, or feel free to email me or give me a call. You can email clem.law@usa.net or phone me at any time at 612-378-7751 if you have questions about the program, and I will answer those in the time permitted by the rules. But today what we are doing is we are, like I say, plodding through the rules of professional conduct as they've been adopted in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and about 40 other states, because most states have adopted these rules more or less verbatim. I always start out the program by saying that, unfortunately, you're not going to get your money's worth out of today's program. And the reason I say that is that very rarely can you just turn to the rules and have a direct answer to the ethical question that is bothering you. Usually when ethical dilemmas present themselves in the practice of law, you usually can't just turn to the rules and find out exactly what you're supposed to be doing, because there are many conflicting rules. They're written in very general terms. So I'm not going to be able to give you very much practical guidance today as to issues that actually come up. So like I say, for that reason, I start with the disclaimer that, unfortunately, you're not going to get your money's worth for the program. Now, I also should point out, though, before everybody starts clamoring for a refund, maybe you will get your money's worth in a couple of ways. First of all, you're probably here today because you need to take the program for CLE credit, and you will indeed get your CLE credit. Those of you in Wisconsin, you need to take the program live. So if you're listening to the program live, you will get your 3 or 3.5 credits of CLE credit in the field of ethics. Well, believe it or not, that's actually the reason most people take the program. So you will get your money's worth in that you will get 3 Wisconsin credits because the program has been approved in Wisconsin. I will be submitting it in other states. So if you're listening in another state, you can rest assured that you will get on-demand CLE credit for the program as well. So you will get your money's worth in that way, and that's good enough for most attorneys. The other thing, though, I discovered is, well, there actually is a certain amount of practical value from today's program. So maybe you will actually learn something useful. Maybe you will get your money's worth out of the program. Because when I first started putting this program together, it occurred to me that I really hadn't sat down and read the rules of professional conduct from cover to cover in a very long time. In fact, the last time that I read the rules in their entirety was when I graduated from law school. I think as a senior in law school, I had to take professional responsibility, and at the conclusion of that, we took the multi-state professional responsibility exam. And to get ready for that, I took a test preparation course, which was kind of the same format as today. We just kind of plodded through the rules and said, here's what the actual text of the rule has to say. So you might get some flashbacks today. But after law school, I never actually sat down and read the rules from cover to cover. In that intervening time, well, some of the rules might have changed slightly. There haven't been very many amendments, but there have been a handful over the years. There might be something that was not in there when you took a course similar to this one. And also, I discovered that in the many, many years since I went to law school and took and read the rules, well, maybe I've forgotten a few of the rules. So it is a good idea to occasionally, anyway, go through this exercise of seeing what the actual text of the rules has to say, even though it's very unlikely that I'm going to teach you anything today that you're going to use in your daily practice of law tomorrow. There's no immediate practical value, I guess is what I should say. But I think there is a certain amount of practical value because it's a good idea to be reminded, because when those ethical dilemmas do present themselves, well, at least the rules are going to be the starting point. If there are two rules that are in conflict about what you do in this situation, well, at the very least, you want to know what those two rules are, so you can figure out what to do about it. Now, when those day-to-day ethical dilemmas present themselves, the advice I give attorneys is, when you don't know what to do, when some problem presents itself, seek the advice of some other attorney. And the reason I say that is, I read, in preparing other CLE programs, I read a lot of ethics opinions from state Supreme Courts. And the one thing that jumps out at me in those is that this lawyer, you're reading this story about some lawyer got themselves into trouble. And almost always, when I read those stories of a lawyer who got themselves into trouble, there was almost always a point where they, made some minor mistake, they messed up. And if at that point they would have stopped and talked to another attorney, that other attorney said, well, yeah, you messed up there, but to fix the problem, here's what you ought to do. Usually there was a simple fix that is sometimes readily apparent to somebody who is not been involved with the problem on a day-to-day basis, that's probably not quite so obvious to the attorney who has that problem. So seeking the advice of another attorney is often a good thing to do. Not necessarily, some formal retainer of another attorney, but just talk to the attorney down the hall and say, what would you do in this situation? Because I messed up, or I don't know what to do in this situation. talk to the lawyer down the hall, or give me a call, or talk to some other lawyer that you trust. Not that that other lawyer is any smarter than you are or more ethical than you are, but it's just the fact that they're not involved in it on a day-to-day basis, and having a fresh set of eyes look at the problem is a good way to handle it. For me in Minnesota, and probably in other states, in kind of an extreme case, is what I can do is I can call up the State Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility and ask for an official advisory opinion. And there are downsides to doing that, but in kind of an extreme case, would give that guidance. Those of you in Wisconsin, I have some special advice for, is that since you are required to be a member of the Wisconsin Bar Association, you have access to the Wisconsin Bar Association Ethics Hotline. And every Wisconsin attorney I've ever talked to who's had to deal with them because they had some ethical question, I always get glowing reviews of that service. So, like I say, since you're required to pay for it anyway, that's a really good source to take advantage of. If you really don't know what to do, or even if you have you're pretty sure what you're supposed to do, but you just need some guidance, feel free to give them a call. And I imagine other states have similar services as that. Your state bar association, if you're a member, or county bar association, I guess, can be very helpful. So anyway, that's the introduction. Before we actually jump into the rules, so I'm going to give a book recommendation. So if you, after listening to today's program, you just want to learn more about the subject of legal ethics, well, in the course materials, and by the way, you don't have to be following along, but if you want to follow along, I have the course materials linked on the page where you signed up for this program. In those course materials, I have a link to a book entitled Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wirtz. And even though the title says Minnesota Legal Ethics, it's relevant even if you're in another state because they're applying pretty much the same rules. But the reason why I recommend that book is two reasons. One is even though it covers the rather dry topic of legal ethics, it's actually kind of an interesting book to read because the author, William Wirtz, was the head of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility for many years, and therefore the book is full of all kinds of interesting war stories about all of the dishonest things that Minnesota lawyers have done over the years. So it's kind of a lot of interesting little stories to read, and each of the stories presumably has a moral that you shouldn't violate rule number so-and-so. So you can check that out. And the other redeeming feature of that book is the price, namely free. Like I say, I have a link in the materials. So if you want, some reading material, you can download that. It's made available for free to everyone from the Minnesota Bar Association. If you want, if you want some light reading material, you can download that to your Kindle or whatever. So anyway, with that introduction out of the way, we will actually jump into the text of the rules. And the rules start with Rule 1.0. And 1.0 is simply a list of definitions. And I'm not going to belabor that by going through the definitions because most of them, the words mean what they say for the most part. So there's nothing too shocking there. But just keep in mind that there are many defined terms. So if you have trouble figuring out the meaning of some rule, perhaps looking up the definition of some of the words contained in the rule might be helpful. Might clarify things, or might make it less clear. Who knows? But keep in mind that that's there. The only two words that are defined that kind of jump out at me as maybe differing from the dictionary definition are the definition of the word writing and the word signature. Well, you know what a writing is. That's when somebody takes a pen and puts it on a piece of paper, or an electronic document even is a writing. We all kind of figured that out. But the definition of the word writing is so broad that it includes a lot of other things, I think. So, for example, a video recording or an audio recording constitutes a writing. So just file that away, that if you ever get in trouble because you know, the rule said that you were supposed to put something in writing, and you forgot to put it in writing. Well, you know, maybe you left a voicemail for the person. And well, that voicemail is a recording, so maybe that qualifies as a writing. You know, I wouldn't count on it if the rule says that you're supposed to do something in writing. Well, it's probably best just to do it in writing. But like I say, if you ever find yourself in trouble for forgetting to put something in writing, maybe that definition might be able to help you out. And also, the word signature is pretty broadly defined. It doesn't just have to be ink on a piece of paper, but it could be, a verbal affirmation. Somebody pointing to the document and say, "Yes, I intend to sign that." I wouldn't count on that, but keep in mind that it is a pretty broad definition. So those are the definitions. But the first actual rule is Rule 1.1. And here I can guarantee you, you're not going to get your money's worth out of my explanation of Rule 1.1 because I'm not going to, I'm basically going to read it. Because Rule 1.1 says that when you're representing a client, you shall provide competent representation. Unfortunately, it doesn't really define the word competence, other than to say that it requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation that are reasonably necessary. So you already knew that. You didn't need me to tell you that you have an ethical obligation to represent your clients competently. But like I say, the rule is not too helpful in telling us exactly what that is, other than we'll know it when we see it, is the definition of competence. So that's the first rule. And like I say, we glossed over that pretty fast. The next rule, however, is probably the one that I would point to and say this is the most important rule, Rule 1.2. And the reason why I say it's the most important rule is that it is often the test of whether or not you've met your obligations under some other rule. So whether or not you've communicated with your client enough you have to look at Rule 1.2 to determine whether or not you've communicated sufficiently. So it's important for that reason. And also, Rule 1.2 kind of provides our job description. So if anybody ever asks you, what do attorneys do for a living, the answer to that question is contained in Rule 1.2. So it tells us what our job description is as attorneys. Well, unfortunately, though, we don't have a very glamorous job description because our job description as attorneys is you shall abide by your client's decisions. In other words, your job description as an attorney is to do exactly what your client tells you to do. You just follow orders. You shall abide by your client's decisions. Now, there are many exceptions to that. If your client wants you to help rob the bank, well, you have to say no to that. But the general rule is you have to abide by the client's decisions. And because it's an absolute rule, basically the burden of proof will be on you to show that one of those exceptions applies any time you did depart from your client's decisions, because this is a very absolute rule. Like I say, there are many exceptions, but I'm going to start by saying one of the exceptions that is not here. The rule does not say you shall abide by your client's decisions, comma, as long as doing so is in your client's best interest. Well, no, that's not what the rule says. If your client wants you to do something that is contrary to their best interests, well, then the default position is you have to do what the client tells you to do, even though that's going to be harmful to the client. Now, there might be situations such as, for example, when we get to, I think it's Rule 1.16, where we're talking about a client who's suffering from a diminished capacity. There might be exceptions. But again, the burden of proof will be on you to show that that exception applies. So you have to be extremely careful anytime you do something, contrary to what your client's stated wishes are. Because our job description as an attorney is to do exactly what our client tells you to do, no more and no less. The corollary to that rule, and we'll talk about some of the exceptions in a minute, the corollary to that rule is that because you're only following orders, your representation of the client does not constitute an endorsement of their political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. So where that, the most obvious situation where that comes up is, I don't practice in the area of criminal law really, but when non-attorneys want to talk to me and they want to have a what they consider to be an intellectual conversation, they'll ask something like, "Well, would you represent a guilty person?" And they think that when they ask that question, I'll have to do a lot of soul searching and whatnot. A lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions. Yes, I clearly represent a guilty person because it's the client's decision whether or not they're going to plead guilty or not, or plead not guilty. So if they make the decision that they're going to plead not guilty, it's my duty to represent them, and I'm not endorsing their criminality. And their political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. And, in particular, in Wisconsin yesterday and Michigan, Michigan yesterday, Wisconsin recently, you see these, heinous crimes take place. I always feel a little bit sorry for that poor public defender who gets appointed, who has to step in there. The client wants to plead not guilty. That's the attorney's duty, and they're certainly not endorsing any criminal behavior that the client did. So I always have a special place in my heart, like I say, when some heinous crime like that takes place. That attorney who comes forward to do their job, and frankly, in those kinds of cases, justice is always done. That public defender is not going to pull a rabbit out of a hat and get an acquittal where there's all kinds of evidence against their client. But like I say, your representation does not constitute an endorsement of the client's activities. Now, exceptions. There are exceptions to when you abide by the client's decisions, and kind of the obvious one is you can't help your client commit conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. Well, that's pretty easy. That's pretty obvious. I don't need to go into too much detail there. If your client says, "Well, I'm going to rob a bank and I need my attorney to drive the getaway car." Well, obviously you can't do that because then you're actively assisting in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. Or your client comes to you with a deed that you know is a forgery and says, take this down to the county recorder's office and record it. Well, you can't do that because you're perpetrating a crime or a fraud by doing that. So most of those situations are pretty obvious. You can't help your client commit a crime. Where it gets a little bit less obvious, though, is the exception to that exception. Because, the exception is you can't help your client commit a crime, but what you are permitted to do, and really what you're required to do because it's your client's decision, you may discuss the legal consequences of a proposed course of conduct and assist the client to make a good faith effort to determine the scope, meaning, or application of the law. And I think kind of an obvious example of that is you're representing this criminal defendant, and trial's tomorrow, and your guy is out on bail, but the case isn't looking that good, and it looks like you're probably going to wind up with a conviction. So you get a phone call from the client saying, does the United States have an extradition treaty with Venezuela? Well, you know full well why the client asked that question, because they're thinking of fleeing the jurisdiction to evade prosecution, and that's a crime. You're not allowed to do that. So if you fly to Venezuela in order to escape prosecution, that's a crime. So the if the client asks, can you give me a ride to the airport because I'm going to flee the jurisdiction, you have to say no because you would be helping them commit a crime. But are you allowed to provide that information about whether or not there's an extradition treaty? And I'm guessing the answer to that question is, yeah, there is an extradition treaty, but it's not enforceable right now because the breakdown of diplomatic relations between the two countries. So after you do the legal research, you come to the conclusion that if your client flees to Venezuela, well, they're off scot-free. They're not going to be able to be prosecuted in the United States. So are you allowed to communicate that information to them? Well, I think this rule is pretty clearly, it says yes, because you're not actively assisting your client in doing anything, but you're simply discussing the legal consequences of their proposed course of conduct. Now, of course, because you're a competent lawyer, you have to explain all of the consequences. You have to say, Venezuela is not a very very good place to visit right now because they don't have any food and whatever. But can you answer that legal question? I think the answer is yes. You can because you're discussing the legal consequences of their proposed course of conduct. The legal consequences of you fleeing the jurisdiction and going to Venezuela are that you're going to escape going to trial. So I think the answer to that is yes, you can say that. Now, when you get to court tomorrow, and the judge asks, well, is everybody ready to go? And you say, well, the defendant's not here. Say, well, where is he? Well, I think he's in Venezuela. Well, the prosecutor might not take quite as charitable a view of that. So that's probably one of those cases. If I got that question, I probably would call the ethics hotline and get their take on it. And also, more importantly, the thing to keep in mind is that once you've had that conversation with your client, practically anything that you do could be construed as assisting in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So you tell the client, no, there's no extradition treaty. And then the client says, well, great, can you give me a ride to the airport, please? Well, then the answer to that question is no, because then you're actively assisting in conduct that you know is criminal. But even the most minor thing, the client asks you that and, say, no, there's no extradition treaty. And the client says, oh, thank you, I'm thirsty, can I have a glass of water, please? And you give them a glass of water. Well, it seems to me somebody could make the argument that you giving them that glass of water was the thing that gave them enough strength to flee the jurisdiction. So you have to be extremely careful once you have that conversation. But like I say, I think the rule is pretty clear that just giving the information is okay. Can you limit the scope of the representation? That's the next subject covered by Rule 1.2. And, well, sure, of course you can. But it has to be reasonable, and the client has to consent to it. But the thing to watch out for here is that consent must be confirmed in writing in most cases. So anytime you're limiting the scope of your representation, it has to be confirmed in writing. The client doesn't have to sign anything. It might be a writing from you, but you have to confirm in writing that the client consented to that limitation. Now, in some cases, that will be blatantly obvious. The client walks in and says, I have these two matters here. I have this criminal case and I have this civil case. Can you represent me on both of them? And you say to the client, no, I can only represent you on one of them. I'm limiting the scope of my representation. So then it's very obvious, and you think to yourself, oh, yeah, the Rule 1.2, I'm supposed to do something. Oh, yeah, I have to confirm it in writing. What you have to watch out for, though, is almost always, anytime a client is retaining you to do something, a case can be made that there's a limitation on the scope of the representation, because that's the thing that you're representing them for. So the client comes in and wants you to look at their lease. So you say, well, yeah, I'll look at the lease for you. I'll read through it and tell you what it means. and they go on their way. And well, unbeknownst to you, they're a year later they're charged with a crime, and they come back to you and say, "Hey, you're my lawyer. I want you to represent me on this unrelated crime." They say, "Well, I'm not representing you for that." Well, a case can be made that you're limiting the scope of the representation. So in other words, the takeaway from this rule is, nowhere does it say that attorney-retainer agreements have to be in writing, but this one kind of strongly implies that anytime you're representing somebody, there should be a writing in existence explaining what you're going to be doing, because, like I say, that case can be made that you're limiting the scope of the representation. And as we'll see in a few minutes, Rule 1.5 has a similar provision that strongly implies that there should always be a writing when you're representing somebody explaining what you're doing. On the subject of limitation of the scope of representation, one special case of that, which in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa and many other states don't have a specific rule, can you limit the scope of your representation to preparing pro se pleadings that will be used by the client? And so, like I say, there's no clear guidance for that in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and most other states. But on the other hand, it's something that I occasionally will do. A client will come to me about some matter that's involved in some kind of litigation, and I'm not able to help them out by being their attorney to represent them, but it might be the kind of thing where they, at least initially, might need to appear pro se. So if they're getting sued and they come to me on day 19 and they're supposed to file the answer tomorrow and I'm not able to take their case, can I prepare a pro se answer for them? Or if they have some matter and the statute of limitations is about to expire, can I draft a pro se complaint for them to file on their own? And occasionally I'll do that. I'll prepare documents for a client and they say, you sign here and, send one copy to the court and send the other copy to the opposing attorney and, kind of give them step-by-step instructions. And so I'm limiting the scope of my representation. So I certainly need something in writing saying that, I'm limiting the representation. I'm not representing you in court. I'm just drafting documents for you. The issue that comes up sometimes, and I don't think the Wisconsin or Minnesota Supreme Courts have squarely addressed this, is the question of, am I somehow misleading the court? Am I concealing my involvement in the case? And I don't think that's a major issue. I don't think that's a big deal. But on the other hand, that argument could be made. So therefore, to protect myself, what I usually do in that case is I follow the Nebraska rule that we'll see here. So the following rule is not required in most states specifically, but I think it's a good idea. It's kind of a safe harbor. Because in Nebraska, in those situations, as kind of a safe harbor to protect myself, if I put on the document that this document was prepared by and put my name and address and bar number on it, then I'm protected from any accusation that I'm trying to mislead the court. Well, in fact, it's required in Nebraska. So what I do in Minnesota is I kind of follow that same practice. I'll give the document to the client and say, sign here. I'm not going to sign anything. But down at the bottom, it will say this document was drafted by and include my name and address. We'll find later on in most states, Minnesota seems to be about the most stringent about it, but it's true in most other states. Withdrawing from a litigation matter is usually pretty difficult, or a criminal matter specifically. Minnesota courts typically will not let you withdraw from a criminal case. Nebraska has kind of a safe harbor for that, and I wish Minnesota and other states would adopt this rule. In Nebraska, you're allowed to make a limited appearance in a matter. So for example, in Nebraska, if a client came to me and said, "Well, I'm charged with this crime, and the arraignment is tomorrow. Can you come and represent me at the arraignment and help me plead not guilty?" And in Nebraska, I could do that by filing a limited appearance. So I'm notifying the court, saying, Judge, I'm here for the arraignment today, but I am not going to be the one trying the case, and I'm not going to, I'm not appearing at all after today. I can do that in Nebraska. In Minnesota, I can't do that, and it's probably true in Wisconsin and Iowa as well. If I show up in court with the client who's pleading not guilty, you know, I'm going to be in it for the duration. So it seems to me that Nebraska rule kind of makes sense because you know, in that situation, maybe that that defendant needs some guidance at that one particular stage. In Minnesota, I'm not allowed to provide that limited guidance unless I'm also willing to sign on until the bitter end. So like I say, that's a useful provision in Nebraska, and like I say, I wish other states had that, because Minnesota definitely does not. Most other states do not. Now, diligence is our next rule, 1.3. And rule 1.3 says don't procrastinate. Now, I'm giving this program live today on December 2nd, you know, so the people taking it live today, some of you might be hearing my voice on December 31st, because that is a very busy day for my CLE business. So if you're listening to me on December 31st, you're going to look at Rule 1.3 and think, they're talking about me. I'm a procrastinator. I put my CLE off until the very last minute. And I'm here to tell you, don't worry about it, because you have in no way whatsoever violated Rule 1.3, because Rule 1.3 says you shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. It doesn't say anything about taking your CLE. So the fact that you put your CLE off until the last minute is a total non-issue. It has nothing to do with representing a client. On the other hand, you have to be careful, because lawyers do tend to be procrastinators, and this rule says not to procrastinate. So it's okay to procrastinate about your CLE. In fact, the reason why you put it off until December 31st is probably because you've been so busy taking care of your client matters. But don't do anything other than diligence and promptness when you're representing your clients. Because it's a violation of this rule, and as the comment points out, no shortcoming is more widely resented than procrastination, because the clients can tell when you're procrastinating, and eventually they're going to complain, and even if their procrastination was not a violation, they'll find something else to complain about. So don't procrastinate when it comes to your clients. What is most commonly procrastinated about? That's probably the next rule, communication. The rules say that a lawyer must communicate in the following situations. And lawyers have a tendency to sometimes be not good communicators or procrastinate when it comes to communication, especially when it comes to bad news. So you have some bad news to share with the client, and you procrastinate about it. Well, don't do that. Because that's a violation of the rule. Fortunately, though, Rule 1.4 does not impose an incredibly high burden for communication. Rule 1.4 says you have to communicate with your client in the following situations. And there are a couple specific things here. Anytime consent is involved. The client consented to something or other, well, you have to have communication, because you can't say, well, my client consented to it, well, but we didn't actually talk about it. Well, obviously, you can't consent without communication. And if it's informed consent, you have to show that you communicated the information that they needed. So you always have to communicate anytime consent is an issue. And you also have to let your client know about any relevant limitations on your conduct. So if you know, some jurisdictional issue or whatever, or timing issue, if you are hampered in any way, you have to let the client know about that. Those are the only two specific ones, but your general duty of communication is You have to let your client know how their objectives are going to be carried out. You have to keep them informed of the status of the matter, and you have to comply with their reasonable requests for information. So you just have to let them know what's going on, and you have to return their phone calls is really all that you need to do under Rule 1.4. So that's not that's not particularly burdensome. It's not a heavy duty that that you have to do. You do not have to let your client know every little thing that happens in excruciating detail. But you will never get into trouble if you do let your client know everything in excruciating detail. So in other words, you should over-communicate rather than under-communicate, because you will never get in trouble for over-communicating, but you might get in trouble for under-communicating. And the test of whether or not you've communicated sufficient information is, did you communicate sufficient information so that the client can participate intelligently in decisions? Because remember, Rule 1.2 says that you have to, you know, your client makes all the decisions. Well, did you give them enough information so that they can make those decisions? And that is the test of communication. And speaking of communication, I will communicate to you the first code number for today's program. Again, if you're taking the program live today on December 2nd, you don't have to worry about writing this down. But if you are listening to the recording, our first code number for the day is A65. A65 is our first code number, A65. So write that down, unless you're driving. If you miss one of these, I'm not heartless. So just if you miss one of them, just explain what happened, and I can I'm good with that. If you miss all of them, well, I might have some doubts. But A65 is the first code number. And that brings us up to Rule 1.5, talking about fees. Yes, we are allowed to charge our clients money for what we do. So that's good news. There's really no limitation other than fees and expenses can't be unreasonable. And I think that double negative is kind of to our advantage, because that means that you don't have the burden of proof to show that your fee was reasonable. Somebody else has the burden of proof to show that it was unreasonable. So you can pretty much charge whatever you want as long as it's not unreasonable. But unfortunately, it doesn't really define the word reasonable or unreasonable, other than to list a bunch of factors. So, again, the real test of, if you charge your client $1 million to, file the quit claim deed, well, that might be unreasonable. But we'll know it when we see it. But these are the factors we use. The time and labor required, the novelty and difficulty, whether that representation will prevent you from taking on other employment, the customary charge in your locality. So you don't have to, do price matching, but if every other lawyer in town is charging $1,000 and you're charging $10,000, well, then perhaps your fee is unreasonable. The amount involved and the results obtained, you can charge more for the big case. Time limitations, the nature and length of the relationship with the client. So you can charge more for your long-time sophisticated client than you can for your brand-new unsophisticated client. Your experience and reputation is a relevant factor. So you can, it's certainly reasonable for you to charge more than the other person in town because, you're smarter than they are, and you have more experience and better reputation, and whether it's fixed or contingent. So like I say, there's no fixed test of whether or not a fee is reasonable or unreasonable. It's just a list of non-exclusive factors. Now, the next part of the rule, and I'm gonna start by saying the Minnesota/Iowa/Nebraska and most other states' version of the rule. Wisconsin has a little bit of a different twist to it, so I'll tell you the Wisconsin amendment in a minute. Fee and scope of representation shall be communicated, preferably in writing. Now, I have certainly never charged an unreasonable fee at any time in my practice of law. If anything, my fees are unreasonably low. and I don't think that's a violation. But if I've ever come close to violating a rule, it was this rule, where it says fee and scope of representation shall be communicated in writing. Because how could I possibly violate that? Well, the phone rings, and somebody asks me, you know, can you do this or that for me? And I say, sure, I can prepare that document that you want, and here's how much it'll cost. And I quote them a very reasonable price, and they say, well, that's a really reasonable price. And I say, well, I'll just get to work on it right away, and I'll send you a bill later on. Well, I potentially violated this rule because I communicated the fee and the scope of the representation, but I didn't do it in writing. Now, why is it that even though this rule exists, I have never been disbarred for doing that? Well, probably because if I got in trouble for it, I would throw myself on the mercy of the Minnesota Supreme Court and say, well, Your Honor, the rule says preferably in writing. So it's not an absolute rule. So I'm probably okay in that case. But it still doesn't answer the question, well, why didn't I do it in the preferable way? Why did I use this non-preferable method of just quoting it over the phone? So to be on the safe side, what I should do in that situation, and I'm getting better at this, is shoot an email off to the client or something saying, thank you for calling today. I'll get right to work on this. Here's how much it's going to cost. So that's really what I should do. That's what I have to watch out for. Now, so that's the rule in most states. Well, that's the rule in every state, including Wisconsin. But Wisconsin goes on to say that in Wisconsin, if the reasonably foreseeable cost is under $1,000, then it does not need to be communicated in writing. So that provision was put in there by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, who is obviously mindful of people like me, who are going to quote these reasonable prices over the phone, and they said there's nothing really wrong with that. So I guess if I did that sort of thing, I would feel a little bit better about it if I was in Wisconsin. But on the other hand, that Wisconsin version of the rule is a little bit of a two-edged sword because, the client called up. I said, oh, yeah, I can do that for you. It'll cost $999. And it turns out I was wrong, and it actually wound up costing $1,001. The reasonably foreseeable cost was over $1,000. It seems to me I'm going to have a lot harder time in Wisconsin throwing myself on the mercy of the court, saying that, well, it's just a suggestion. It said preferably in writing, because it's kind of a black and white, is it under $1,000 or is it over $1,000? So like I say, it's a little bit of a two-edged sword. If it gets close to that $1,000 mark in Wisconsin, then I think you definitely want to have it in writing. Whereas, for the $999 case, I could probably get away with not having a writing here in Minnesota. So watch out for that. The fee and the scope of the scope of representation shall be communicated preferably in writing. And again, like we said before, limitations on the scope of representation, the scope of the representation shall be communicated preferably in writing. Again, there's no rule saying that attorney-retainer agreements have to be in writing, but here, preferably, the scope of the representation shall be communicated in writing. So, I am drafting a quitclaim deed for you. That's the scope of the representation. That should really be in writing because not only is it a limitation, but, this rule says that the scope of the representation should be in writing. And like I say, in Wisconsin, you can probably get away with not having it in writing as long as you're absolutely sure it's going to be under $1,000. But probably good practice everywhere. Okay, contingent fees are the next subject addressed by Rule 1.5. Contingent fees defined as, the amount of money you make depends upon what happens in the case. So pretty broadly defined. It's not just, a percentage of the recovery, but contingent fees have to be in writing. So that does have to be a formal written contract, and the rule specifies exactly what has to go into that contract. And the one that jumps out is if it's a percentage recovery, your contract has to address whether that percentage is calculated before or after expenses. But there are some other specific requirements. So before drafting that document, make sure you look at your estate's version of Rule 1.5. But as long as you follow that, contingent fees are allowed in any kind of case whatsoever, with two exceptions: family law cases and criminal cases. Oh, wait, that doesn't, how could you have a contingent fee in a family law case? You know, I'm going to get one third of the alimony. Well, that would obviously be a contingent fee in a family law case. But remember, it's much more broadly defined than that. So if you say, well, you know, I will charge you this amount if we get the restraining order. I will not charge you if we're denied the restraining order. Well, that would be a contingent fee in a family law case and not permitted. As far as percentage of alimony or child support or something, there might be an exception if you're collecting an old judgment. Because then, you know, you're allowed to collect on that judgment. That gets to be a fine line. In fact, the child support guidelines in your estate might have some specifics on that. So be extremely careful if you do that. But in general, in the family law case itself, there's never a contingent fee, nor in criminal cases. So how could you have a contingent fee in a criminal case? Well, the most extreme case would be, you know, no fee unless you're acquitted. I'll represent you, and you know, you'll walk, or you don't have to pay. You know, that would be a pretty extreme case. Probably not a real good idea from a business point of view, but it's also prohibited by this rule because you're not allowed to charge a contingent fee in a criminal case. But the leading case, maybe a little bit more reasonable application of that rule, comes from Wisconsin, where a Wisconsin attorney was advertising that in a drunk driving case, he would win your case or you would get a free bicycle. So it was kind of a win-win situation because no matter what happens in the case, your transportation needs will be taken care of. So either the lawyer wins your case and it's like the DWI never happened, and you're not in jail, you get your car back, you get your driver's license back, everything is good, and you can keep driving to work. Or maybe things don't go quite so well, but at least you can still get around because you have this new bicycle. So it's kind of a win-win situation. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, no, you're not allowed to do that, because that amounts to a contingent fee in a criminal case, because you're making less money in cases that you lose because you have to cover the cost of the bicycle. So again, contingent fees are addressed there, and they're permissible in everything except those two kinds of cases. The final subject addressed by Rule 1.5 is fee splitting. Now, before we talk about fee splitting, I'm just going to give you a preview because, well, you know, we'll be all tired in a couple hours when we get to Rule 7.2, I think it is. Because Rule 7.2 says that that referral fees are not permitted. You are not allowed to take money for referring a case to another attorney, and you're not allowed to pay anybody for referring a case to you, including other lawyers. It's not permitted. So whatever you do, never pay or receive a referral fee because it's not permitted. Now, when I say that, occasionally lawyers will say, well, wait a minute, I thought referral fees were allowed in the following situations. As long as you jump through the following hoops, then the referral fee is permissible. And they're not totally wrong when they say that, because those hoops that they talk about are what we're about to talk about here. So I can't really say they're wrong, but it's a very, very poor use of language, because referral fees are not permitted. There's something similar to a referral fee is permitted, but don't call it a referral fee, because that's kind of like admitting guilt. So it's kind of saying, well, I accepted this referral fee, but it was okay because I jumped through these following hoops. That's kind of like saying, well, you know what, I just committed a murder, but the murder was okay because I was acting in self-defense. Well, yeah, that's not totally wrong, but you don't want to use those words, because it's not murder is allowed in these cases. It falls outside the definition. So similarly, there's something that falls outside the definition of a referral fee that is permitted, and that is two attorneys working together on the same case. You know, you and I are working together on this case. I'm going to do half the work. You're going to do half the work. And when we're all finished, I get half the money and you get half the money. Well, that's certainly okay. And that's what this rule says. Splitting fees between more than one attorney is okay as long as it's in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. Now, Minnesota and most other states use the word proportion. Wisconsin, to kind of stress one point, doesn't use the word proportion. I think they use the word relation. It says in relation to the services provided by each lawyer. I don't think there's any practical difference between those words. But the reason why they used a different word in Wisconsin was just to stress the fact that it doesn't have to be down to mathematical certainty. So in other words, you know, I did, you know, 41% of the work and you did 59% of the work and we're splitting the fee 50-50. Well, that's still okay because, you know, it doesn't have to be an exact proportion, but it has to... the test, it basically has to be is, well, am I getting, is the amount of money I'm getting, you know, commensurate with the amount of services that I provided? You know, if I got the check for $5,000 when the thing was done, can I truthfully say that, yeah, I did $5,000 worth of work on this case? And as long as I can answer that question in the affirmative, then it's okay. And it's okay to split the fee with another attorney. Even if one of us referred it to the other one. So in other words, I did a third of the work on the case, you did two-thirds of the work on the case, and when the case was over, you sent me a check for one-third, but I sent the case to you because you're in a different state, and I needed an attorney who was admitted there, so I sent the case to you. So when the case is over, you send me a check for the third, but that's for the third of the work that I did, not for the fact that I'm referring it to you. In fact, when you send me the check, you better not write down at the bottom referral fee, because I would send the check back to you and say, no, it's not a referral fee. I'm splitting the fee with you because I was performing part of the work, and I'm not going to admit to guilt of accepting a referral fee. So that's what the rule says. Now, there's one more word in there that one attorney pointed out to me that, well, you don't I don't have to provide any services really under this rule as long as I am maintaining responsibility for the case. So the same hypothetical, I have this case and you know, I'm not admitted in your state, so I referred the case to you. And you did, 99.99% of the work. I really didn't do anything other than, telling my client, here's the phone number of this other attorney. Give them a call and tell them I sent you. That sounds a lot like a referral fee. Well, that's okay as long as I'm getting that money not for referring it to you, but for maintaining responsibility. So I didn't just give the client your phone number and said, tell them Clem sent you. I said, this other attorney in this other state, I'm going to refer you to them. And I tell you what, I'm not actually going to work on the case, but if this other attorney that I'm referring it to, if they commit malpractice, I am assuming full responsibility for their malpractice, even though it was not my fault. In fact, the Wisconsin version of this rule is very clear because it says the level of responsibility must be comparable to that of a partner. In other words, if you commit malpractice, I agree to be on the hook. If this other attorney commits malpractice, I want you to come and sue me, even though I didn't do anything wrong, then it's permissible. But if I try to weasel out of that in any way, I say, well, you better sue the other guy first because it's not really my fault. Then I'm not maintaining responsibility for purposes of this rule. Is the client really paying you to maintain responsibility, or are you really getting paid for the referral fee? That's pretty close to the line, and I would be very uncomfortable in a situation like that. But certainly, if I refer a case to you and get paid under that rule, I certainly want to make sure that we do not call it a referral fee. So like I say, don't say, I got a referral fee in this case. What you say is, I was being paid because I was maintaining responsibility for the case while the other attorney was working on it. And as a practical matter, I would not do that unless I actually was providing services, because then I can make sure that I'm maintaining responsibility. So anyway, that's why some attorneys say referral fees are okay as long as you jump through those hoops. But like I say, I think that's a pretty sloppy use of language. You have to watch out for that. And incidentally, not every state has that rule. I assumed they did. And all of the states in this immediate area, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Illinois, Indiana, all have that rule. Interestingly, though, apparently Michigan does not have that rule. So if I were a Michigan attorney, you can pay referral fees to people, and you don't have to pretend that there's something else. And apparently California has a similar rule as well. But in our states, referral fees are not permitted. And again, Rule 7.2 is what actually bans them. But this Rule 1.5 opens the door slightly. Okay, Rule 1.6 talks about confidentiality. And before we talk about Rule 1.6, I want to make clear what we are not talking about. We are not talking about the attorney-client privilege, because that's a separate subject. And the attorney-client privilege is actually quite narrow, and it really doesn't apply very often. Because the attorney-client attorney-client privilege says, I'm just checking my email real quick. Just wanted to make sure nobody else signed up at the last minute. The attorney-client privilege says that if a client communicates with their attorney for the purpose of receiving legal advice, or the similar medical privilege, if you communicate with your doctor because you want to get medical treatment, that communication is privileged. So if you have that conversation with me, you tell me information, and then the next day I get a subpoena from the grand jury, and the grand jury says, we want you to tell what your client told you yesterday. Well, the answer to that question is I refuse to answer because that's privileged. Well, that's never actually happened to me. So it's kind of safe to say I've never really had to deal squarely with the attorney-client privilege. It's just something that's never come up for me. However, the confidentiality being talked about here comes up all the time because this rule says that everything you know about your client, not just stuff that was communicated by the client, but just anything that you learn in the course of representation, so everything that you know after being on the clock, all information relating to the representation of a client, it becomes confidential unless you can fit it within an exception. So unlike the attorney-client privilege, which very rarely comes up, and there are many, many exceptions, and it's, as a practical matter, it just doesn't apply very often, this confidentiality applies all the time, because this rule says that even for things that are not privileged, you shall not reveal that information, period. It's kind of an absolute rule, and if you do reveal information relating to your client or relating to the representation, you have to be the one, you will have the burden of proof of showing that some exception applies. So in other words, anytime you talk about your client, anytime you open your mouth, the burden of proof is on you to show that, this exception applies. So, your client comes in, and this might be information that is in the, public knowledge. Everybody knows this fact, so it's not really confidential, but it's confidential as far as you are concerned. Your client is wearing a yellow tie today, and they're walking down the street, and everybody in the world sees them wearing a yellow tie. And so if I see your client walking by, I say, oh, there goes this guy, he's wearing a yellow tie. You are not allowed to say that, because that's information relating to the representation of a client, because you've discovered that he was wearing a yellow tie because he was sitting in the office. Now, in that particular case, there might not be any harm. You probably won't get disbarred for it. But that you are not to reveal that information unless one of these exceptions applies. And perhaps there's probably an exception. The first exception is the client consents. Well, clients can consent to anything. But the biggest exception is disclosures that are impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So in other words, the rule says don't say anything at all about your client unless it's necessary to say that in order to carry out the representation. Because you are disclosing information about your client all the time. In fact, that's why your client hired you. That's your job. Your job is to disclose information. You have to disclose the information to the insurance adjuster, or you have to disclose the information to the judge. You have to disclose that information to the jury. You know, that's what you're being paid to do. You know, so obviously you have to disclose, you have to reveal information. But the burden of proof is on you to show that, yes, this was necessary in order to carry out the representation. So if that's one of the elements of your client's defense that they were wearing the yellow tie, well then obviously you have to disclose that, because your client was wearing a yellow tie and the guy who committed the crime was wearing a blue tie or whatever. It's authorized in order to carry out the representation, but you can't just disclose information about your client unless it's necessary to do so, or unless some other exception applies. And there are many other exceptions to that, but the biggest one, like I say, is don't reveal information about your client, comma, unless it's necessary in order to carry out the representation, or some other exception applies. Now, the first other exception here is one you spent a lot of time talking about in law school, probably. It was kind of a fun topic for your professors to bring up. What if you discover your client is about to commit a crime? What are you supposed to do with that information? Well, here it varies a little bit on what state you are in. And before we move to Minnesota and Wisconsin, for reasons that I hope will be apparent in a minute, we're actually going to start with the Nebraska version of the rule. Nebraska attorneys will be taking this program later, so we have to start somewhere, so we're going to start with them. So we've all moved to our Nebraska office. So we're sitting there in our Omaha office, and our client just storms out of the office and says, I'm going to go murder somebody. What do we do with that information? Well, we reach down from the shelf and pull down our Nebraska Rule of Court book and look at Nebraska Rule 1.6. And that rule says that we may reveal the information if it's necessary to keep the client from committing a crime. Well, sure enough, it is. So Nebraska Rule 1.6 says that as soon as your client storms out of the office on the way to commit the murder, you can call up the Omaha Police Department and say, you better go to this address because my client is about to commit a murder at that address. And if you get there in time, you'll be able to prevent the murder from taking place. So the Nebraska Rules of Court say we may do that. On the other hand, it's a nice day outside. It's maybe the weekend is coming up, or it's at the end of the day or something. And if you make that phone call, it's gonna mess up your entire weekend. The police will be in asking questions, and they'll want to know different things. So you just blow it off, and the client storms out of the office and goes and kills somebody. Not a problem at all, because we're in Nebraska. Well, now, those of us in other states, the thought of that, that's just appalling, that our colleagues down in Nebraska are literally letting their clients get away with murder. That's not something we countenance in most other states. So therefore, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, the rule is worded a little bit differently. and in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We changed the hypothetical, and this whole incident takes place in our office in Minneapolis or in Madison, and there the rule says we shall reveal the information if we believe it's necessary to keep the client from committing a crime. So we can give ourselves a pat on the back that we're morally superior to these Nebraska attorneys because we are required to call up the police department and say there's a murder about to take place at this address, go down and arrest our client. So like I say, we can pat ourselves on the back with that. There, on the other hand, I see the practical reason why Nebraska has the rule the way it has. And I actually think that Nebraska made the right choice in putting the word may rather than shall. Because if you read a little bit further, this isn't just for any crime. You are required or permitted to reveal the information if it's a crime that's going to result in death or serious bodily injury or a substantial financial loss. So clearly, a murder, your client storms out, I'm going to commit this murder. Well, in Nebraska, we are permitted, and in Minnesota and Wisconsin, we are required to disclose that information. And we'll talk about the special case of Iowa in a minute. That's a pretty clear case. And in fact, I've met many of these Nebraska attorneys, and they seem like the kind of person who probably would call the police in that situation. Where it gets a little bit more difficult, though, is that if it's a minor crime, so instead of a murder, you discover that your kleptomaniac client is going to go down to Walmart and commit some shoplifting of a candy bar. So you know to absolute certainty that your client is going into Walmart to shoplift one candy bar valued $1. What do you do with that information? Well, that's not a serious crime. You should probably try to talk your client out of it, but ultimately there's not going to be any death or serious bodily injury or any substantial property damage. So you are not permitted in Nebraska, nor are you required in Wisconsin or Iowa or Wisconsin or Minnesota to call up Walmart security. In other words, it would be a violation of the rules of ethics for you to call, tell them that, hey, this guy's in there shoplifting right now because it's just not a serious enough crime. Where it gets and you knew that, but where it gets a little bit more problematic is what happens if your client is not going to shoplift a candy bar, but they're going to go shoplift, let's say, a $1,000 laptop. So they're going to go down to the store, and to an absolute certainty that they're going to shoplift a $1,000 laptop. What do you do in that situation? Well, the answer is I don't know what you should do in that situation. In Minnesota or Wisconsin, well, it says you shall reveal the information if it's a substantial amount of money. But on the other hand, the rule also says that you are required to not disclose the information if it's an insubstantial amount of money. So does $1,000 constitute a substantial loss for purposes of this rule? I simply don't know the answer to that question. And if you guess wrong, you're going to be in trouble. So you say, well, that sounds pretty substantial. I better call the cops. And, you get in trouble because you disclosed confidential information about your client and because the court decided it was insubstantial. On the other hand, you decide, confidentiality is important. I'm going to keep it quiet. I'm not going to say anything. Well, then you get in trouble because you failed to disclose it because the court decided after the fact that it was a substantial amount of money. And I don't know what you would do in that situation. I guess what I would do is if I was in Wisconsin, I would call the Wisconsin Ethics Hotline and ask them, or if I was in Minnesota, I would call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility and ask for an advisory opinion, because I simply don't know. Whereas if I was in Nebraska, I would err on the side of caution. Say, well, I don't know if 1,000 is substantial or not, so I'm just going to err on the side of caution and treat that information as confidential. So, like I say, the Nebraska rule makes a little bit more sense because you have that safe harbor murky situation. Whereas in most other states, you have to kind of come up with a decision on what to do. Iowa, interestingly enough, uses a little bit different approach. They also use the word may. So in Iowa, this is all happening in Des Moines. It says we may reveal the information if we think it's a serious crime, but we shall do it if we think the harm is imminent. So I guess the only difference is in Iowa, you know, if your client tells you I'm going to go murder somebody tomorrow, you don't have to make the phone call until tomorrow, until the harm is imminent. But so as a practical matter, I don't know if that makes any difference. Those of you in Wisconsin, you want to look at the rule on because it has some additional language for some things that do not constitute criminal offenses necessarily. So let's say there's some situation, you know, some property damage, and you know your client's dam is about to burst, and you know, through no fault of their own, and it's going to flood some neighboring property. Wisconsin gives you permission, is a little bit more permissive in what you are allowed to disclose that information to third parties, because harm will result even though it's not a criminal offense. So it gives you a little bit more leeway to use your discretion, I think, the Wisconsin version of the rule. Okay, a couple of other exceptions to confidentiality. Disputes with a client. Your client is suing you over the fee, or they're suing you for negligence or something. To the extent necessary, you can reveal otherwise confidential information. You can reveal confidential information to get legal advice about your conduct under the rules. So when you call the Wisconsin Ethics Hotline, or when I call the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, or when I seek advice of the attorney down the hall, yes, I can reveal confidential information to the extent necessary. You can reveal information to comply with a law or court order. So in some of those situations, that might be the best safe harbor to rely on. If you don't know whether or not you're supposed to disclose this $1,000 theft, and it's involved in litigation somehow, and you know the court is involved, you know, if you can dance around the issue enough so that the court orders you to provide the information, then you're safe if you're complying with that court order. Although if the court order is you don't think is proper, then you might have to make sure that your client is aware of the possibility of the appeal. And also, to the extent necessary, to ascertain whether a conflict of interest exists, you can reveal confidential information. So that's Rule 1.6. Everything is confidential. And at this point, I'm going to give our next code number for this portion of the program. And that code number is B27. B27. B27 is our next code number. B as in boy, 27. Our next rule, and I think we'll go for about another 10 minutes or so, then we'll take a short break, and we'll get our full 3 hours in. But like I say, we'll take about a 5 minute break here in another 5 or 10 minutes, probably after we talk about conflicts of interest. Now, Rule 1.7 is the rule talking about conflicts of interest, and Rule 1.7 is definitely a rule where you will not get your money's worth out of my program today, because Rule 1.7 is not very helpful, because it tells you something that you already knew. Rule 1.7 simply says, do not engage in conflicts of interest. And you knew that. You knew conflicts of interest are something you're not supposed to do. But it doesn't really even define a conflict of interest, other than to say you can't represent one client directly adverse to another client. That's kind of the extreme example. But more importantly, a conflict of interest exists if there's a significant risk that representation of one or more of your clients may be materially limited. So what does that mean? Well, we'll know it when we see it. So like I say, Rule 1.7 is very important because, you know, that's, you know, conflicts of interest are what get, you know, you can get in a lot of trouble if you're engaged in a conflict of interest. But this course is really not helpful in helping you identify or avoid conflicts of interest because Rule 1.7 is just written in such general terms. And for purposes of a program like this where we're just plodding through the rules, I'm not really going to be able to add too much value to that. In the past, I've done another program on conflicts of interest where I spent 3 hours, and I thought to myself, you know, clearly after 3 hours, I'm going to be able to, give a definitive talk about what conflicts of interest are. Even there, I discovered I was just scratching the surface. In devoting 5 minutes to talk about Rule 1.7, there's really not much I can say other than avoid conflicts of interest. So obviously you can't represent clients against each other. There are some situations where clients consent to it, and you can represent both parties. So, for example, what happens if two spouses come in and says, you know, we want you to, you know, we have decided to get divorced, and we have decided that it's going to be amicable, and we want you to represent both of us. Can you do that? Well, the answer to that question is no. The answer to that question in Iowa is a definitive no, because Minnesota and Wisconsin don't have a specific rule about that, but it's a very bad idea. But there's no specific rule against it. In fact, if you look at the Minnesota statutes, there's something called a joint petition for dissolution of marriage, and right there in the statute, you know, it shows and the lawyer for the two clients signs here. That's a bad idea to do that. I don't know if any attorney has ever done that. Usually, you know, you have to make clear, I'm only representing one of you. And in Minnesota, we call it a default. The other spouse proceeds as by default. So don't do it. But Iowa has a very specific rule saying you can't do that. Where I would watch out in Iowa is what if these divorcing spouses just come to you because they're an attorney and they want some informal guidance before they proceed pro se. And I can see doing that in Minnesota. I can see telling the clients, oh, I'm sorry to hear that you're getting divorced, but if you go to the court website, you can download the forms and fill them out and file them with the court, and it won't be, and if either of you has a problem, you should each talk to your separate attorney. But I think I would feel comfortable in Minnesota or Wisconsin giving that much advice. But in Iowa, it says, in no event shall a lawyer represent both parties in a dissolution of marriage. So I guess in Iowa, I would be very reluctant to say that same thing. You know, the two of you go to the court website and download the forms. I guess you can make the argument that they're not a party at that point, but it seems like kind of thin ice. So watch out for that, but especially in Iowa. Like I say, it's a bad idea in other states. So, but anyway, that's all I'm going to say about Rule 1.7. I am going to talk more about Rule 1.8, not because Rule 1.8 is more important. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about Rule 1.8, much more time than we spent on Rule 1.7, even though Rule 1.7 is the important rule. But the reason why we're going to spend time talking about Rule 1.8 is because it has a bunch of specific rules covering specific situations, which is more amenable to today's program. So, for example, the first thing the Rule 1.8 talks about is a transaction with a client where you have an interest adverse to your client. That happens sometimes. In fact, arguably, it happens all the time because your client owes you money. So can you have an interest adverse to your client? Yeah, you can do that quite often. It has to be fair and reasonable. The client has to consent, and you have to advise the client in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. So, for example, that adverse interest might be as a result of the attorney-client relationship. You know, your client doesn't have enough money to pay you, so they sign you a promissory note. Well, then you have an interest adverse to your client because you're holding this piece of paper saying that they owe you money. Or it might be unrelated to the transaction. So, for example, you are the attorney for a car dealer, and, well, you decide to buy a car. Who are you going to buy it from? Well, buy it from your client. But what if the car turns out to be a lemon? Well, then you have an adverse interest against your client. You're the attorney for the grocery store, and you go in and you buy a gallon of milk, and, you know, maybe the milk is bad or something. So there's, any time you engage in a business transaction with your client, there's a potential that this rule kicks in. And the sad story about this rule came from one attorney who took my program, who got himself a private reprimand for violating this rule. Because what happened, he gave me permission to talk about it. What happened was he was representing his wife's parents, actually like their family business. So his wife's parents owned a business and they needed a lawyer. So, you know, he was the attorney for this family business. And everything went well. He was diligently representing them. And then at some point during the marriage, they borrowed money from the wife's parents for like a down payment on a house or something. So perfectly normal transaction, happens all the time. But in this case, he was borrowing money from his client. So this rule kicked in. But the transaction was fair and reasonable, sure, and the clients consented to it. But, they wound up getting divorced. And it turned into an ugly divorce with all kinds of accusations being leveled. And the parents lodged a complaint with the state bar saying our son-in-law, or no good son-in-law, violated Rule 1.8. Because he engaged in this transaction with us where he has an adverse interest. And say, well, was it fair and reasonable? Well, I guess it was fair and reasonable. Did you consent to it? Yeah, I guess we consented to it. Well, then what's the problem? Well, the problem is our no-good son-in-law never advised us in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. And sure enough, that's what the rule says he was supposed to do. So he should have sent, you know, he should have sent a thank you note saying, thank you for loaning us this money. This is great. Thank you very, very much. P.S. I hereby advise you in writing about the need to talk to another attorney. If he had done that, he would have been okay. But he didn't. So keep this in mind that, anytime you engage in business transactions with the client, this this transaction might surface. Keep that in mind, and so maybe it's a good idea to put in the boilerplate of your attorney retainer agreement that if those situations ever arise, run it past your own outside attorney, then you would have been protected. Gifts from clients. So your client is sitting there and gives you $1 million, that's great. There's no rule against that, but you're not allowed to solicit that gift. You can't say to your client, boy, sure would be nice if you gave me a substantial gift today. Don't do that. But more importantly, don't draft the document naming yourself as a beneficiary, such as a will. Now, here the rules differ a little bit from state to state. In Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and most other states, the rule simply says don't do that unless it's a relative. And there, that's all the rule says. And so if you're drafting it for a relative, it's okay for you to draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary. Wisconsin has a little bit more complicated version of the rule. But even for attorneys in states like Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska, I strongly encourage you to follow the Wisconsin version of the rule. Because the Wisconsin version of the rule basically incorporates by reference the law of trusts and estates as they existed in Wisconsin in 1840 or something. Because All Rule 1.8 says is, are you going to get disbarred for drafting this will? And you don't want to get disbarred, so you want to follow the rule. But you also want to make sure that you actually get the money. Well, the probate court will be applying a different test. And in Wisconsin, it's kind of an all-or-nothing proposition, because the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in deciding whether or not you're going to get disbarred for drafting this will apply the same rules that are applied by the probate court in deciding whether or not you're going to get the money. So in Wisconsin, if you violate the rule, you get disbarred and you don't get the money. In Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, most other states, if you violate this rule, you're not going to get the money, but you're not going to get disbarred. So I guess you get something to show for it. But it's better if you get the money. So you want to make sure that you follow the Wisconsin rule. So, and it's a little bit more specific. You're not supposed to get gifts. You're not supposed to draft a document giving yourself a gift, such as a will, unless the client is a relative. But not just any relative, like in Minnesota. You have to be the natural object of the bounty of the client. In other words, you have to be a relative of about the same relationship that would normally get a gift of about this much. Let's see, I'm just going to have to slow down here for a second. I have to log back into my computer here where I'm keeping track of attendance. It times out after a while. So anyway, it has to be a close relative and natural object of the bounty. That's, it's kind of up to the probate judge to decide. The amount of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. There can't be any grounds to believe that the instrument will be contested, or there can't be any grounds to believe that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. So you draft this will for your parents or for your brother or whatever, you don't get disbarred in Minnesota, but then you have to go to probate court. And there, the probate judge is going to decide whether or not the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Well, you're really running the risk of the judge just not liking you and saying, the gift looks okay, except, maybe the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar, so we're going to take the money away from you just to be on the safe side. You don't want that to happen. So the short version is, whatever state you're in, don't draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary, even if it's a close relative, because it's just too risky. That's something. So if your close relatives need their will drafted, send them to another attorney, because then you just avoid this problem entirely. Because in most states, you're not going to get the money. And in Wisconsin, to add insult to injury, after the probate court takes the money away from you, you get disbarred. So you don't want that to happen to you. You can't take literary rights based upon the representation. Because then, the O.J. Simpson case, he comes to you, he doesn't have any money to pay you, but he signs over the book deal. Well, no, you can't do that. You can't provide financial assistance to a client other than advancing the costs of litigation under certain very limited circumstances. If your fee is paid by somebody other than the client, you have to keep in mind that under Rule 1.2, your client is still the client. So the people paying your fee don't have any say over how the case is carried out. Common situations where that can arise is insurance defense. The insurance company is paying your fee. Well, the insurance company understands how this works. That won't be a problem for you. But in a criminal defense context, that's where it also often comes up. You're representing the criminal defendant, but the parents are paying your fee. Well, the parents might say, I want to handle the case this way. Well, no, that's not their call. Your client gets to make that decision. I'm going to give one more code number right now before our break. Our next code number will be C54. C54 is our next code number for this portion of the program. C54. Car 54. Where are you? There. C54 is our next code number. If you're representing more than one party, then an aggregate settlement has to be approved by all of your clients. Comes up, it's more likely to cause conflict where you're representing more than one defendant, and the corporate defendant wants to take the settlement, but the individual defendant wants to go to trial. That's up to the individual defendant. That kind of thing can happen. Never ask your client to prospectively waive a malpractice claim or to turn you into the disciplinary authorities, because even asking them is a violation, even if you didn't do anything wrong. Now, you can waive past claims, you know, as part of a settlement, but if you are settling a potential malpractice claim with an unrepresented person, you have to tell them in writing that it's a good idea for them to obtain outside legal advice. You can't acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action other than an attorney's lien or the contingent fee, and the attorney's lien is governed by, you know, some statute, kind of a technical exception more than anything. You can't acquire an interest in the cause of action. Despite many movies and sitcoms to the contrary, a lawyer related to another lawyer in a familial or romantic capacity cannot represent clients who are adverse to the related attorney. So you can't, you can't have a husband and wife, prosecutor, defense team going up against each other in court. Like I say, despite that being a plot device in many a TV show. And a client shall not have sexual relations with the client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about imputed conflicts of interest in a little bit, but the in general, with the exception of that last paragraph, all of these prohibitions apply to all lawyers in the same firm. So in general, if you have a conflict of interest, so that, then so do all of the other attorneys in your office. So at this point, I want to take a short break, mostly because my phone line actually times out after a certain period of time, so I have to kind of reset it. So what I am going to do, for those of you listening to the podcast, I'm going to turn off the recording at this point, and we will pick up in the next portion of the program with the next rule. So thanks for joining us. Again, any questions about this program, send them to clem.law@usa.net.